How and why David Kahn
well,
get that
the
job?
Why being the bigger question.
Yes. I'm looking at myself like I did not know who he was. And I said, what kind of a beat writer was I on the Indiana Pacers? Like, David Kahn, what?
You're ready to
like,
switch careers.
So I'm calling people back in the Pacers front office. I'm saying, where was this guy? What am I missing? And I was getting all sorts of horror stories.
TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand. It's Minnesota Sports Rewind.
Phil Mackey here, along with Danny Cunningham and Manny Hill from Score North, and John Krasinski from The Athletic. And gentlemen, we have gathered here today to do a full retrospective breakdown of what was simultaneously one of the most, sadly, noteworthy games in Timberwolves franchise history, but also one of the most bizarro world games in Timberwolves franchise history, the Kevin Love 30 and 30 game.
Look at this man. Somebody get on this guy. It's like the ball is gravitating to him.
18 rebounds. 16 points.
Was it as bizarro world when it actually happened as it was rewatching it?
No doubt. Yes. I was there.
You were. Now, that was before they moved the media seats to the corner, right? Were you sitting courtside?
No, I was in the corner for that. Yep. So it was, yeah, but it was literally the kind of game that totally sneaks up on you. You know, it was, I think it was a Friday night, and it was, you know, Knicks, Wolves. Nobody was really excited about it.
And it wasn't on TV locally.
It wasn't
right?
on TV locally, which was the most amazing thing because, especially during this time, like the Timberwolves marketers and all, they are trying whatever they can do to generate any kind of interest in this team, and swinging and missing, and then they finally have this history making performance, and nobody who wasn't at the game locally saw it. It was just like you should have seen the ashen faces on like the business side as they walked out the door, being like, "I cannot believe we missed this opportunity."
So just to set the scene, because this was November of 2010 now,
yeah.
Which doesn't like okay, it doesn't seem like that long ago. But when you and we're going to dive into every angle of this game and this era of Timberwolves basketball. But when you watch the game itself, it feels like it was maybe from the late 90s or something. But when if you don't even account for some of the crazy names and players on the court, like Darko Milicic and Sebastian Telfair were in the starting lineup for the Wolves in this game. Kevin Love grabbed – just a few facts from this game to set the scene. Kevin Love grabbed all 31 rebounds, almost all 31 rebounds, between the second and third quarters.
Right.
So he went into halftime, I want to say with like – it was 7 minutes to go in the second quarter
when he scored. Yep.
And he had three rebounds at that point in the game. And then he winds up with 27 rebounds with like 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. So everything came in this in terms of rebounds in the second and third quarter. The Wolves were down by 20 points at one point in the third quarter. They win the game by double digits. So it was – I left that game early, actually. I was at the game. I was there, and it was like a Friday – it was a weekend.
It was Friday night.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean – the Wolves games were nondescript.
Yeah.
It was just a terrible era of Wolves basketball. And I remember thinking, oh, it's halftime. They're down by 14 points or whatever. Like, there's nothing happening in this game. I'm going to go home. And I remember turning on the radio and hearing Alan Horton going bonkers on my car ride home. What is happening right now? So what stands out when you think about the game itself? And Johnny, you were there.
Yeah.
And I know Manny's been watching Wolves basketball. Danny, it's best because Danny's new to Minnesota here. Mm-hmm. So you get to relive some of this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start with Johnny and go around there. What stood out most in terms of the game itself?
Well, yeah, I think it was literally one of those things where and Kevin Love did this a lot in his career with the Wolves, where you watch him and he's playing and you're thinking, yeah, he has a pretty good game. And then you look down at the box score and it's 22 and 22. Like, he just had this way of amassing stats in an unspectacular way. It was just workmanlike.
Corner jumper by Fields, no good. And a tip by Gallinari, and Love's got another one. 27. So team record. A franchise record by Love.
That's coming off the 24 against the Lakers.
Al Jefferson held the previous record.
And so that whole first half, it was they were not playing well. He was not particularly involved. And you're just kind of like, eh, this is a lazy game. And then the third quarter comes, and he gets 15 rebounds in the third quarter alone. And all of a sudden, you look down at the box score sitting in front of you at the, you know, on my little media lectern, and you're like, oh my God, he has 22 rebounds. And then all of a sudden, it's, oh my God, he's got 27 rebounds. And then it was an immediate scramble, like, he's going to get 30 rebounds. Like, when is the last time that's happened?
Love. Stoudemire blocked him, but he tipped it in. He's got 31 rebounds and counting.
And like the Timberwolves PR people are digging up all the stats, and Charles, it was since Charles Barkley in 96 and all of these other things, and you're thinking, God, this is unbelievable. And so not only while that is happening and you're headed toward history that way, but the Wolves were clawing back into it, and it was a 20-point lead, and the Knicks just kind of stopped playing, and Kevin Love didn't stop playing. And so then, you know, now he's starting to hit shots. And, you know, now all of a sudden this really sleepy Friday night crowd starts to realize what's happening. And they see, you know, on the box score, Kevin Love has 24 rebounds or something. So every time he grabs a rebound, he's getting an ovation.
And the Timberwolves are having their way with the Knicks right now, and Love can tie it up. Does.
This crowd in a frenzy now about a comeback by the T-Wolves.
T-Wolves 10 of 27 in the third, but they got all those rebounds.
And then, you know, they're cutting the lead to 10, to 8, to 6. He hits a jumper from the baseline to tie the game, and the place is starting to go bananas. And so it just turned from this nondescript game that no one would ever talk about, you know, ever again to, oh my gosh, like that was really, really fun and really, really cool.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the crowd reaction is to hear how much louder they start getting for rebounds.
Because exactly.
Every time someone gets a rebound in an NBA game, it's a real nonchalant applause. But Kevin Love's at like 25 and they start going nuts. I'm like, this is amazing, just seeing a crowd appreciate a guy getting a rebound. It was. And obviously the game wasn't telecast here, so the broadcast was on MSG for the New York market, and Clyde Frazier does color for them. He did at that time and still does. And after the third quarter, they showed a graphic saying that he had 15 rebounds in the third quarter alone, right. And it was three away from the NBA all-time quarter record. And he's just like, I can't believe how many rebounds he's gotten. And it was incredible because everything happened in that second half, basically. Mm-hmm. He only had two rebounds in the first quarter. I think he had seven in the second, and then that 15-rebound third quarter. I'm like, this is unbelievable. I can't imagine he just keeps getting rebounds. And there felt like there were probably five or six more that he should have had. Like, he easily could have had a 35-rebound night.
Yeah, and a lot of it came with the typical Love stat padding in terms of he would miss a bunny, get it back, put it back.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, and this was also in the very early days of Twitter, kind of, like, pretty early, where, you know, it was harder to get the word to spread quickly, but I started to sound on the tweet, Love has 26 rebounds, Love has 27 rebounds. And then, like, it felt like people were watching on their phones as well in the arena, and they're like, oh, bleep, here we go. Like, this is pretty fun.
I just remember Kevin Love just not getting off to a very good start in this game. And you're watching him, he's missing all of these shots in the first quarter, and you're knowing, you know, watching the game back now and seeing him, you know, get off to that slow start, and you're thinking, this is amazing how he could get off to this bad start and still end up with 31 points and 31 rebounds in a game. And another couple of things that stood out to me was Anthony Tolliver was on the Timberwolves at the time.
Yes, he was.
And it stood out to me because there were three players on the Wolves that I noticed watching that game. Three players on the Wolves at that time that had two different stints with the Wolves. Anthony Tolliver, Sebastian Telfair, and Corey Brewer.
Yeah.
All three of those guys had two different stints with the Wolves, and they were
totally
all on the team.
I forgot
at the same
that Telfair had two stints with the Timberwolves.
Yeah. I think he had a stop. Danny, you probably would know this. He had a stop in Cleveland in between, right?
He was part of those really bad Cleveland teams for a little bit there. Yeah. He was in that non-LeBron era that happened in Cleveland. He was there for a stretch, but he was the only starter that didn't score in this game. Like, he played 36 minutes, almost 37 minutes, and did not score.
I have a factoid about that. I did some digging on that exact thing for a little bit later on in the show, and I'm excited. Like, my first thought was, how can that be possible? How can you be out there for 36 minutes? It actually happens a little more often than you'd think, but it happens in spurts. The thing that stood out the most to me was, I think, just the transformation of Kevin Love the last nine years.
Yeah, so he's doughy.
He looks like a different human, right? Mm-hmm. So he, if you're near a mobile device or something, just Google Kevin Love 30 and 30 game and just look at what he looks like in that game compared to what he looks like now as this sort of, he's like a male model.
Yeah, Banana
now,
Republic
right?
model.
In this game, he does not look like someone that Banana Republic wants designing suits for.
Back then he was the doughy everyman. Like, that's what, like, Wolves fans really loved about him was he was just this kind of guy who, not chiseled, definitely a few extra pounds on him, had this old man game. Like, he didn't play above the rim. You know, he knocked down threes and he grabbed rebounds. But he was also at that point, like, super gregarious. And he was going out to street corners in Uptown and handing out free Timberwolves stuff. He was really engaging with the public. And then, you know, you get to the David Kahn contract stuff, and he sort of turned into this sullen guy, which was really a shame, because that Kevin Love that had 31 points and 31 rebounds was just this happy-go-lucky, this is awesome kind of a guy. And he, you know, his Timberwolves stay kind of ended poorly with just kind of retreating into himself as he was so unhappy with things. But yeah, I mean, he was incredibly popular at that time just because he was fun to talk to and people could relate to this, you know, to this guy who was not doing anything spectacular besides whatever stats that he put up. And as much as they were losing, it was kind of fun to watch him start to find his way that way.
Yeah. That game was a microcosm of his time with the Timberwolves, where you, at the end of the game, I mean, if you weren't aware of the crowd noise and what was happening, you look at the box score and wonder, wait a second, how did he grab that many rebounds? Because when you think of great rebounders in previous or even current NBA, it's guys who sky, right? It's guys who are just more athletic and grab the ball above the rim, or like KG's rebounds were always, he skied up above everybody and then clamped the ball with both hands, right?
He made you know he got the rebound.
Right. Yes. And Love would be like, there'd be traffic under the rim and the ball would drop, and all of a sudden, like, Love has the ball with one arm like a running back and he goes back up and gets fouled and falls to the ground, and the crowd cheer, like, how did he get that rebound? It doesn't make any sense.
He was so crafty and he was just so instinctual. He could read the ball coming off of the rim better than anyone, so he had so many rebounds that just fell into his lap because he was in the right place, and he also was really savvy with, he used those meat hooks, and like, he would, you know, sneakily grab the guy right next to him and hold him down, and then grab it with one arm. He had all the tricks in the trade that way. He had a big ass at that time. He was using it to clear him out a little bit. Like, it was never, you know, it was never, I'm leaping up over everyone and grabbing it in traffic. It's, I'm going to, you know, wedge my way into the crowd, elbow some guys out of the way, hold somebody down, and then it's going to fall right into my hand. His instincts are second to none in that way.
And I mean, I'm sure someone can find someone else, but it's hard for me to think of someone that just consistently found themselves in better defensive rebounding position than Kevin Love did. Because, like you guys said, he wasn't the best athlete. I mean, he looked like a normal dude aside from being 6'10". He just looked like a normal American guy. But he was always in the right place at the right time, and that's why he got so many of these rebounds. And it's been like that his whole career. Obviously, he doesn't look the same now as he did back then. He's a little more Banana Republic than he was then. But he still finds himself in the right place at the right time almost all the time, and that's why his rebounding numbers are consistently towards the top of the league.
And this game, too, I think sort of symbolizes sort of his rise to being a star player in the NBA, because he made the All-Star team later that season. And it was kind of his coming out party, because everybody, he's on SportsCenter and everybody's saying, you know, 31 and 31, and that point, I think the rest of the league started to figure out that Kevin Love is like a really good player, because here locally we could kind of see what he was doing, but I think this game really helped him sort of get a little bit more awareness around the league that he's a legitimate star player in this league and he's going to be good for a long time.
What did you guys make of that version of Kevin Love? The one that, I mean, the numbers he put up during that era. So he led the league in rebounding that season. He went on to average
15 a game, I think.
Yeah, 15.2 rebounds per game that year. That was the year, too, where the double-doubles just came flowing, and it was double-double every single night. So he had a stretch where he averaged – this was his third year in the NBA, where he averaged 20 points, 15 rebounds on 42% from three. The next year – and he was an all-star both these 2 years. The next year, he goes to 26 points, 13.5 rebounds, a couple assists, still shoots 37% from three. And then the knuckle push-ups thing happens, and he gets a year wiped out. But then he comes back, and again, it's 18 points, 14 rebounds. It's more three-pointers. It's 40% from three. And yet the team didn't win. The team never finished above 500. So he was putting up these historic numbers for a big man, and the front office is questioning him. They don't want to give him the five-year max. People around the league are questioning, are these hollow numbers, or is he just rebound hounding? What did you make of that version of Kevin Love?
Well, I think at that time he was as good as any power forward in the league from a production standpoint, obviously. There was always a question, and I think it's been proven that he was not the number one guy on a championship contending team. You couldn't win a championship with Kevin Love being your number one. But what he showed in Cleveland is that you can win with him being your two or your three, depending on, you know, what's going on in that game and the role that he can play. And so I think that, you know, he was penalized in the court of public opinion for them not winning. I mean, but you look at some of those teams that were around him, and yeah, they were not exactly loaded with talent. But he also wasn't the guy that was going to raise the level of play of a lot of guys around him. He was going to get his, and he was going to wax whoever he played head-to-head, but he needed more help. Like, that's what they hoped Beasley was going to be, and never happened. That's what kind of they hoped that Rubio was going to be, and he got hurt, and that didn't transpire. So he at that time, and really even now, he's an all-star caliber talent. He's just not top five, top six guy that you want to say, okay, we got Kevin Love, now we're going to the Eastern Conference Finals, the Western Conference Finals type of guy.
Yeah, because I think it was, his last year here when he averaged almost 27 points, and he finished, I think, in the top five in the MVP voting or mm-hmm. near it. And that was, okay, is this guy a top 10 player? Because that's what I was in Cleveland at the time, and that was the excitement. They're like, the Cavs are trading for a top 10 player to pair right. with LeBron and Kyrie. Like, this team is going to win the championship, no questions asked. And I think had they not gotten hurt that year, they might have. And even, I think in a non-Warriors era that we're in, Kevin Love probably could be the number two on a championship-winning team. But because of what right. they've been able to do out in Golden State and just how good that team got, he was a number three and still won a title. And I think that he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, he's a great player. Like, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, when you say that he's like not a number one or like not top five in the league, well, that, you know, that's not any slight on him. I mean, he's just right. not LeBron, Anthony Davis, you know, that kind of
realm. Even then, since the 2012 finals, the best players on championship winning teams have been LeBron, Steph, Kawhi, and Kevin Durant. Like, yeah. That's it.
Yeah. It's not really hard.
It's almost unfair to say, well, he can't be the best guy on a championship winning team, because who can be?
That's
like,
right.
We're talking about maybe the greatest basketball player of all time, the greatest shooter of all time, a seven-footer that can get a bucket whenever he wants, and the guy that could do everything offensively and was the best perimeter defender in the league. Mm-hmm. Like, though, yeah. That's the criteria.
No doubt. Yeah, it's a very hard bar to climb.
I also wonder, too, when you look back at the David Kahn era.
Yes, let's go into the David Kahn era, please.
Well,
let's dive into
The totality of just bad trades, bad signings, bad draft picks. You just wonder if, you know, what this team, the direction this team would have gone in if better front office yeah. work had been done. And if Kevin Love would have ended up staying around longer, because sure. they're winning more, they're contending more, he's got better teammates around him, he doesn't want to get out of here, that sort of thing. And you, I mean, obviously, everybody looks at, you know, drafting Johnny Flynn over Steph Curry, and that's the big one because of the megastar that Steph Curry has become. But you go back to the next year, that Kevin Love has this great game, you take Wesley Johnson in the draft that year. Was it Boogie Cousins?
Yep,
I think
right.
that went
yep,
the pick after.
Five, yep.
Paul George goes six picks after that. I mean, you put one of those guys into this mix instead of Wesley Johnson, and who knows the direction that this franchise goes.
This, in fact, I'm just going to read the names of the players that played minutes for the Timberwolves in this game. It is peak David Kahn roster.
Yeah.
This is – so the starting lineup was Kevin Love, Michael Beasley, who, by the way – so Michael Beasley went for 35 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, and 3 steals, and was the Energizer Bunny during this game. If you were plopped down to earth and you just watched this game and said, all right, who are the star players – are there any star players in the league that are playing in this game? You'd say, well, Kevin Love, workmanlike, but the real star on the court is Michael Beasley.
Yeah.
And Beasley had 42 the game before against the Kings. The 35 wasn't even his season high. Yeah, he scored 42 two nights before.
That was like the heart of the Michael Beasley might be getting it sort of trend, because it was 42 and 35. And then there's a few more games where he had 28 and 30, and you were like, this guy is putting it all together. Here he is, like, finally coming together and putting the problems behind him, and he's using all this talent. And then he really, really severely sprained his ankle and went right into the crapper. Like, it was, yeah, but there, I right at that, in that probably 2 week period of Timberwolves history, there was an actual hope that Beasley and Love, here it goes. And they're ready to happen. And then it just, you know, bad luck. And then, of course, you know, bad everything. I mean, we'll get into more of the players, but also Kurt Rambis. Like, that was a terrible hire.
A shot. The MSG production crew showed a shot of the bench, and it was Kurt Rambis sitting right next to Bill Laimbeer. And they'd be like, okay.
And that,
that says so much.
That assistant coaching staff was terrible as well. I mean, JB Bickerstaff was like a really young kind of player development guy, assistant.
And was he was Reggie by far Theus
the, yeah, Reggie Theus, Reggie Theus, Dave Wohl, and JB was by far the most the most skilled coach on that team, and it wasn't even close. It was just a brutal staff.
So the rest of the starting lineup for the Wolves, so Beasley and Love, and then you had Wes Johnson, Sebastian Telfair, Darko Milicic, the starting center. Off the bench, you had Corey Brewer. This is the first benchmark. We're going to have a few benchmarks to sprinkle in throughout this episode. Benchmark number one, I can't remember that guy existed category. Sundiata Gaines played 11 minutes for the Timberwolves in this game and went 0 for 4 from the field with 2 turnovers. So Sundiata Gaines.
The only reason I knew he existed is he hit a buzzer beater when he was with the Jazz against the Cavs in Utah, because Cleveland just had nightmares in that arena, and he was one of them. Yeah. That's the only reason I knew who he was, because he came onto the floor. I'm like, oh my God, he played for the Wolves?
Yeah.
Like, it was one of those 10-day things.
Thing. Yeah. It was like a 10-day thing. Amazing. Not a 10-day because it was too early, but I mean, I think they had some other injury, and I can't even remember who their other point guard was that got hurt. But
Johnny Flynn.
Oh, that's right.
Johnny Flynn. A couple shots of Johnny Flynn sitting behind the bench in a suit, which is what his basketball card will be remembered for. Anthony Tolliver, Kosta Kufos, Nikola Pekovic. This is a rookie, Nikola Pekovic, and then Lazar Hayward. Wasn't he a second round pick at one point?
Late first round.
And a space cadet. Like, I mean, Lazar, I loved him. He was a super nice guy, but man, some of the things that he said and some of his philosophies on life were totally out there.
Did he think the earth was flat too?
It was along those lines. Like, it was pretty amazing.
This is the most rhetorical question of all time, but if you have inside information on this, Johnny, this would be a great place to share it. How did David Kahn get that job? How and why did David Kahn get that job?
The why being the bigger question. Yes.
So, I mean, there's a whole, I mean, this could be its own show, but like, when they went into searching for a new GM to run the show, they first of all, Glenn Taylor was having some health issues at the time, and so he really empowered Rob Moore to kind of go through the search and conduct the search. And Rob did not belong in that kind of a position of authority. So that is on Glenn, first and foremost. But, I was talking to people who did interview for the job at the time, and there was a personality test that they had to take. There was all of these hoops and things that they had to jump through. And like one of the guys who...
They must have scrapped that before the Tom Thibodeau hire.
Yes. One of the guys who interviewed for the job was brought up to do the interview for the job is Dennis Lindsay, who is now the GM of the Jazz, who is a phenomenal GM. And, you know, Rob Moore asked him to take this personality test, and he said, no, I'm not going to take this personality test, and he left. And so this was the kind of process that was playing out. And David Kahn was an opportunist and kind of, I think, could sense, you know, he desperately wanted to get back into the league in a decision-making role. He had been on the front office with the Indiana Pacers for a little while and had gotten buried there because I'll tell you a quick backstory and side story. I covered the Indiana Pacers before I covered the Timberwolves, before I moved back to cover the Timberwolves in 2005. And I covered the Pacers for 2 years and really closely. And so now flash forward to when they're doing this search, David Kahn's name comes up, and you know, former Indiana Pacers GM, the Wolves are quietly trying to put out while this is playing out, like, hey, he was Donnie Walsh's right hand man, and I'm looking at myself like I did not know who he was, and I said, what kind of a beat writer was I on the Indiana Pacers? Like David Kahn, what?
You're ready to switch careers.
So I'm calling people back in the Pacers front office. I'm saying, where was this guy? What am I missing? And I was getting all sorts of horror stories about, trust me, you weren't missing anything, because he was initially involved in decision making there, but then it was so clear that he was unliked and just in over his head that they essentially put him on constructing the Conseco Fieldhouse, the new basketball arena there for the Pacers, to give him something to do to stay away from everything else that was going on there, stay out of the basketball operations. And
I feel like that's kind of what the Twins did with Bill Smith. Now, Bill Smith was not nearly as in the doghouse as David Kahn, but that's kind of what they did with Bill Smith. Like, oh, we're not going to let him go, but yeah, let's just work on blueprints for Fort Myers.
Exactly. Right? And so that arena, when the arena got finished, there was nothing else for David Kahn to do, and he kind of was just put in mothballs and like, hey, your desk is actually in storage room B. Like, you
know, like, go get your swing line stapler.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So anyways, so I'm getting all this information about David Kahn, and meanwhile, like the Timberwolves are, you know, we're having back channel conversations as we always do in these sorts of situations, and I'm telling them, like, hey guys, like, I'm hearing some bad stuff, like that, some reasons to be concerned about if this is the way you go down, the path that you go down. And I relayed those. I had talked to a few people in the D League, which is now the G League, because he was again being like putting himself off as this architect for a couple of franchises down there. And he had outstanding lawsuits against him and all these things. So I'm passing this information on, and it got passed on, but they literally couldn't find anyone else.
Bill Simmons was like, remember
he
that?
Was,
like,
yeah,
Bill
he put Simmons in this, like, hire me. Like, yes.
In retrospect, now that we look back 10 years later, would you rather have had Bill Simmons as your GM or David Kahn?
Very important. Yeah.
Bill Simmons is the
it's
answer.
A great point.
And Bill Simmons just would have traded Kevin Love to Boston.
But that's how it all played out. And so then, but Rob Moore and David Kahn kind of, you know, charmed and got his way in with that. And I'll still, like, I still remember the opening, the AP story for David Kahn is hired off of the opening press conference. That's supposed to be kind of all good feelings, that everyone's always optimistic. I had a D-League, a business owner who worked with a D-League team that David Kahn ran in Texas, quoted in the story saying, I wouldn't trust David Kahn as far as I could throw him.
Wow.
And then, so that kind of just set up an ominous, you know, kind of beginning for where this thing could go. And that's how it happened. And Glenn was not really overseeing it at the time because he was dealing with some of his own issues, and it didn't work out well.
Now, what was the connection to Portland with David Kahn? Was he like a sports writer in Portland?
He was a sports writer.
That's how
he
knew
Portland.
Rick Adelman,
yep,
right?
Yep, he was a sports writer in Portland. Kind of had like a Sid Hartman like notes column, so it wasn't like he was a, you know, just like this flowery prose or, you know, or anything like that.
Sid Hartman doesn't have flowery prose?
not necessarily.
Headline, Johnny Krasinski and Sid Hartman.
He was a notes columnist there, and he also had tried to get Portland an expansion baseball team. So okay. He was kind of involved in a few things there that didn't work out. But yeah, I think that is part of the connection that got him connected with Rick Adelman.
Yeah. Wow.
What an era, man. I mean, that's just like, there's a book to be written at some point, and I hope that you're the one to write it. Maybe you're already done with it, and you're just playing your cards close to the the vest. I have a where are they now on David Kahn for you guys. And Johnny, you guys probably all know this, but for the audience, so this is from some random article I put. This news was announced about 8 months ago. Former NBA Timberwolves president of operations, David Kahn, is the president of newly formed professional basketball team, Paris Basketball. The team will compete in France's second-tier Pro B division next season. Kahn announced the move on July 12th in a press conference with the Paris mayor, who gave her support to the project. His goal is to have the team competing in EuroLeague by 2020. So he's the owner and operator of a B-level team in Paris, France.
That's quite a fall from running an NBA team to owning a B-level team in France.
I'm actually surprised that he's even there.
Allowed like, to be
yeah,
in basketball?
I mean, he's tried. He has made many efforts to get back into the NBA. He has burned a lot of bridges. This is obviously him trying anything impossible to stay in it.
He did say in the article, he was quoted a few times in the article saying that he's made about 14 or 15 trips to Paris, and he's really excited to just like immerse himself in Paris. Can you imagine David Kahn? Is he just soloing 14 trips to Paris?
Who knows? How's he paying for that? That's the question.
What do you guys think was the worst move he made in his time here?
Well, I mean, passing on Steph Curry twice has to be, right? Hard. But the fact that that might not – that you have to rack your brain because there were other moves, you could argue once – because Ricky Rubio, it wasn't like – like Johnny Flynn was a disaster. Yeah. But Ricky Rubio was a good player. Mm-hmm. When he was healthy, he was a good player. But not giving Kevin Love the 5-year max because you're saving it for Ricky Rubio was another thing that essentially put a nail in his coffin and sent Kevin Love out of the franchise, and they had to hit the reset button again, and then they wind up getting Andrew Wiggins, and that's the era that they're still stuck in here. But I would say passing on a Hall of Fame and slash the greatest shooter of all time twice, it's tough to think of another move that's
that will haunt him forever. There's no question about it.
Yeah,
for me. I agree. Like, it's that one, but I mentioned it earlier. You take Wesley Johnson at number 4 in 2010 in the draft, and you got Boogie Cousins there at 5. And, you know, Boogie really probably should have been the number 1 overall pick that year, but there were character concerns about him coming out of Kentucky, and that's why he fell. But you've got him sitting there. You got Paul George, who went, you know, 5-6 picks later, and to take Wesley Johnson, who was like the oldest player in this draft with very, very, very limited upside, it was bonkers to me that this guy comes in, takes this job, and says he's preaching about forward thinking and we're not trying to win right now, and you know, we're going to let this thing slow cook, and then you take. In your second draft, you take the oldest player in a draft because he's quote unquote the safest pick.
Yeah,
because you're worried about Boogie Cousins and you know all that stuff. That to me just inexplicable to me when you look at how good those two guys, Boogie and now Paul George being an MVP candidate now. I mean, to do that to me is just mind boggling.
All right, Anthony Tolliver, now you were on your first stint with the Minnesota Timberwolves during the Kevin Love 30 and 30 game. You played in the game. When did you realize that 30 and 30 was a thing that was happening in front of you?
You know, honestly, I don't think it was something that people were paying too much attention to until, you know, he got above 25 and 25. You know, he had plenty of 20 rebound games, plenty of obviously 20-point-plus games. So, you know, it wasn't really, you know, something we were – you know, paying too much close attention. But once he got above 25 and 25, I think that's when it became, wow, this could actually, he could maybe get to 30 and 30. But yeah, I mean, it was something we were, like I said, we were aware of, but we don't, you know, we didn't, I don't remember us changing our game or doing anything differently, but maybe playing a little bit harder on defense so that we could maybe get an extra stop.
And this all happened really before we really vaulted into the social media age that we're currently in. So whether there was a celebration or not in the locker room following the game, I don't think anyone really knows. What was it like after the game when the team was together in private?
I mean, it was definitely just a lot of fun. You know, I wouldn't necessarily call it a celebration because obviously we're still in the middle of the season, and it was just, you know, we won the game and it was an individual feat. But we won the game, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
You were down by like 20 points
at
one point.
That's what I thought. I was making sure. I was like, wait a second, that was 2010. That was a long time ago.
it was like one of 17 wins that season.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't too many of them. So that's, but, you know, as far as that goes, yeah, we definitely gave him his props and, you know, kind of enjoyed the moment because, you know, it was definitely one of the highs of the year.
We were digging through. It's such an, when you look back at that roster, and the Wolves were in a spot where let's take a shot on Michael Beasley, let's take a shot on Darko Milicic. Sebastian Telfair played, was it 36 minutes?
Sebastian,
didn't,
yeah, he
score,
like,
but passed.
Had 8 assists. I mean, yeah. Kevin Love wasn't even the leading scorer for the Wolves that night. It was Michael Beasley had 35 and Kevin Love had 31.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was not just the Kevin Love show. Like, Michael Beasley, and I think the game before, I forget where you guys were, but Michael Beasley had 40-plus points the two nights before this one. It was wild.
Yeah, there was a 2 or 3 week stretch that year where Michael Beasley looked like, man, this dude's going to score 25 or 30 points a game, and they might have caught onto something here. Mm-hmm. What was it like being on that team with all those guys who were trying to jockey for position, not only on the team, but just to maybe stay in the league?
It was definitely interesting. Interesting locker room. And actually, not going to lie, like, those guys are awesome people. I mean, all those guys, and, you know, we liked each other. It wasn't like it was a bunch of misfits that, you know, didn't like each other or didn't get along. Everybody got along. It was just wasn't a great group of mixture of basketball players. You know, a lot of individual talent in on that team, just not very good camaraderie on the court. And it just, you know, it showed in the fact that we didn't win very many games, you know, so. I know we battled with injuries and different stuff. I mean, that's every team pretty much every year, right? So you can't really use that as an excuse. It's going to happen. So, but for us, it was more so, you know, a lot of guys, like you said, kind of trying to maybe is their second or third chance to try and prove themselves. And I think it became a little bit too selfish, yeah. of a environment, and everybody was trying to, you know, like you said, jockey for position. So it ended up, you know, taken away from the team aspect.
By the way, during the, so we watched the, I think it was only available with the Knicks feed,
yeah,
because
so
it was
the,
not telecast.
The game was not broadcast in Minnesota. Like, yeah. Fox Sports North just didn't have the game. I don't know what the issue was, but it was only on the Madison Square Garden channel. Wow. In New York. So that's what we went back and rewatched, and I forget who was doing play-by-play, but,
well, Clyde Frazier
did color.
He didn't get the memo that you had worked on your three-point shot over the offseason. Mm-hmm. It's like, as you're pulling up for a three-pointer from the left wing, I think he made a comment like, oh, Anthony Tolliver, man, not much of a three-point shooter.
There you go. He thinks he's a three-point shooter now, huh?
Right. Tolliver, not a good perimeter shooter.
On cue.
Yeah, I knew he would do that. But the Knicks would live with him making threes.
And I think you went out, you shot like 40% from three that year. So,
yeah.
But like, that one comment was hilarious.
No,
because now,
no, I remember that. Like,
really?
I'm dead serious. I still remember. That's actually one of the people who stick out in my mind. I always think about stuff like that. Like, it's just funny. Like, he obviously didn't do his homework. It's because that's literally what I started doing at that point in my career. I was shooting a lot of threes, and it's just funny. You know, I take it. I didn't take it as a slight. I just thought, I was like, that's funny. He didn't do his research.
And that wasn't the only thing that he kind of said that he might regret. Like, he was also kind of talking crap on the Phil Jackson triangle system, and because that's kind of something that was going on here at the time. And then 2 years later, the Knicks hire Phil Jackson.
Yeah, right,
so it wasn't
right.
The only regrettable thing that he said that night on the broadcast.
Yeah.
It was really funny.
Yeah, it's, you know, There's some interesting people around the league, put it that way.
I guess. Where does that game rank in most memorable games you've been a part of, either pro or otherwise?
Definitely top five. As far as just individual performances, it's up there. I've never really thought back and put them in order, but you know, a couple I can think of is, it's actually funny because three of them involve the Wolves. So
Derrick Rose 50 in that?
Derrick Rose 50, yeah, for sure. Actually, four of those involve the Wolves, so either on the Wolves or against the Wolves. So Derrick Rose 50, Kevin Love 30-30, Tony Parker 55 here.
That's right.
Yes. Wow. I was on that team against the Wolves, and I scored my career high 34 against the Wolves back in – again, whenever I was with the Warriors. So that's probably my top four memorable individual performances.
Was that 34? Was that like a revenge game in your mind going in? Did you say
that was before I played for the Wolves.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was actually probably a big reason why they signed me. Was because I played really well against them. Those top... probably my top four most memorable performances, and then maybe like another one in the top five. In the top five would be either Carmelo's 60-point game against us when I was with Charlotte, or LeBron's 60-plus-point game against us. Yikes. When I was with Charlotte. So yeah. Both those were they would probably tie because that's a little bit more personal.
That's quite a list.
Both of those guys scored some of those points on me, not a lot of them, but some of them.
Some other things from just going back to the game itself, the Knicks broadcast team had some amazing just like little things that so one of the comments that Frazier made was about how Phil Jackson assistants have never had success with the triangle, essentially saying that like Phil Jackson when him or his assistants haven't had Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant, the triangle's a joke.
Yeah.
Triangle has only worked for Phil Jackson. None of his coaches, former coaches, have had success with the triangle.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah. Well, and like 2 years later, the Knicks give Phil Jackson $10 million a year to be their operator. That was amazing.
That might have been my favorite one-liner that he had. He had a couple of really funny ones. Like, he talked about how that game was too fast-paced for his liking. I'm like, oh, wait 10 years, man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Also, something that kind of stood out to me, too, was Anthony Randolph, who eventually played for the Wolves, was on this Knicks team. And I noticed him out there. I was like, Anthony Randolph?
Yeah.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Yep. Huh. That I still remember because right before that game, Frank Isola, who I think everyone knows, was traveling with the Knicks at that time. And we were kind of sitting out on the court pregame, and Anthony Randolph was shooting. And I remember saying to Frank, I'm like, oh, yeah, Anthony Randolph. I'm like, I'm surprised that he isn't doing a little more for you because there were so many people that just really liked his potential as this new age, do everything kind of three, stretch four, whatever you want to call it. And Frank was the same. He's like, yeah, I know. He hasn't really panned out. They were really high on him, though, and it looked like he was going to fit in well. And that's the story of Anthony Randolph's life here and there and everywhere else that he's gone.
In his Knicks career, he played 17 games and averaged 2.1 points a game.
Yeah. And because he had, before he came to the Knicks, he was with the Warriors and had like a couple of really big games. Mm-hmm. And then when he came here, he had one or two that were 22, 23-point games. You're like, oh, okay. But, those were just flashes in the pan.
He was another example, too, of just how many guys that David Kahn would just take a flyer on.
Yep.
David Kahn spent most of his time, aside from making bad draft picks and bad signings and everything, he always brought in just like these guys who had potential or were drafted high, but they were sort of casted off by their previous teams. Michael Beasley, very high draft pick. Darko Milicic had been bouncing around the league. Anthony Randolph was another one of guys that were just had potential and people liked them coming out of college, but they never really panned out and they were just sort of cast offs. And David Kahn was sort of the king of taking a flyer on those type of guys.
And I don't even mind that approach necessarily if you're a team that's down in the stands, just see if you can steal something. But that can't be like your main thing. Like basically they were taking him and saying, we need Michael Beasley to be the Michael Beasley that everyone thought when he went right after Derrick Rose. Like, that's what we need. No, you hope that you have a core in place, and then you grab you take a flyer or two on some of these guys, and maybe they turn out, and great. And if not, okay, well, see you later. We'll stick with, our Kevin Love and DeMarcus Cousins or whoever, Steph Curry, whoever you draft. But, that was like a core tenet of his, was like, I'm smarter than anyone else, so I will grab somebody for cheap, and then I'm going to be dubbed a genius when he pans out, and it like just literally never did.
And then if you question a season of Darko, and then gave him a 4-year contract.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, competing against no one else for an offer. Like, Darko literally had no other offers.
And then if you question him in a press conference, he'll say, show of hands.
Yeah, right.
Fun facts from the box score of this game. So we brought this up earlier, but Sebastian Telfair, 36 minutes, 0 points in this game. And Frazier at one point on the MSG broadcast said, you must have a lot of family watching this game. He looks a little tight out there. Like, no, Telfair just can't score.
Yeah, I know.
Actually. I looked up on Basketball Reference how many times in the last 30 years has a player played 36 minutes and not scored? And it actually happens more frequently. It's happened 4 times in 2018 it did. It hasn't happened, or was it this year? It was either this year or last year. It happened 4 times, but then it didn't happen 4 years between.
Who was the last player?
Wilson Chandler twice, Dragan Bender, and Trevor Ariza a couple times.
Okay.
Jason Kidd did this a bunch of times.
But still had double-doubles.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, he would have the 15 assists, 10 rebounds, and would have 3 shots taken. And Shane Battier was a multi-time offender of this, where he would just be roaming around playing defense and standing in the corner.
Yeah.
And so if he went 0 for 4 from 3, he didn't score, but he played defense for 36 minutes, right? And the other fun fact from the box score that I found, and if you guys have other ones, throw them out here. The Knicks played an 8-man rotation in this game. The Knicks only played eight guys.
It's Mike D'Antoni, man.
They played. It's November 12th it's the beginning of the season, and Mike D'Antoni, which is a whole separate topic too. The fact that his career at that point as the failed coach of the Knicks, who would have thought that he would have this renaissance in Houston and be basically one injury away from maybe winning the NBA Finals? But the Knicks played an 8-man rotation on the second week of November in the regular season.
Got to win the game at all costs, whatever it takes.
D'Antoni on the bench, when they showed him, he just looked like he missed Phoenix so much. That was what I thought when I saw his face. He's like, man, I miss the Phoenix Suns.
I need me some Q Rich, some who else was on that? Well, he had Amari Stoudemire.
Yeah, Stoudemire. Yeah.
They'd signed Amari that summer leading into the season. And
then later that year, they traded half their roster for Carmelo Anthony.
That's right. Yeah.
And then how about, did you guys, anything else on the box score that stood out to you guys?
Well, we are lamenting Wes Johnson, and rightfully so, but remember, like this was, I think, his box score, 15 points on 6 of 9 shooting, 3 blocks, 4 boards, like that was what you hoped you could always get from Wes Johnson.
He had a good, he had a good game.
He looked good, his shot looked great, and I still remember watching him as a rookie down in Mankato when they were scrimmaging, and it just looked like he knew what he was doing in terms of the shot. I mean, form was nice, and he's this 6'7" guy. He looks the part so much, and so when you look at that, you said, man, like that's your formula here for success with this team. Beasley scoring a lot of points, Love doing the dirty work, and Wes Johnson just filling in and hitting those open jumpers, blocking a few shots, and obviously it didn't work out. But still in the league,
he is
playing for New Orleans.
Yes,
I mean he.
How?
I think he's
not a good shooter.
He's
really
one of those guys that when you just look at him, you say that's a basketball player.
Yeah.
You say that he looks the part, but then when he gets out there, I mean, it just he's just not it. And so I think he keeps tricking people into it. Now, he's also a super good guy, so you know that he's not going to rock the boat. You can bring him in at a low salary and see what you can get for him. But, he's the ultimate eye test fool. Like, you look at him and you're thinking, man, he should be a heck of a lot better, and he just doesn't.
Manny, you got the box score over there? Anything that stand out to you?
Well, Kosta Koufos getting 3 minutes in this game for the Wolves really kind of stand. Because Kosta was the guy that came over from Utah for Al Jefferson. I think it was Costa, and then what was it, two like protected first round picks or something like that from Utah for Al Jefferson. And you know, Costa's bounced around the league a little bit, and he's, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's still
Sacramento.
He's still in Sacramento. Yeah. So it is kind of amazing when you look at some of these players. I mean, it was 8 years, you know, eight some odd years ago, but you look at some of these players that are still in the league, you know, hanging on. You know, you look at Costa Kufis, you look at, I mean, Corey Brewer and Wesley Johnson, as we just talked about, too, and Beasley's bounced around a little bit, but he's still hanging around the league, too. So, I mean, that's kind of what stood out to me, is just looking up and down both of these rosters, really, and seeing guys in the league that are still in the league now, and then also being reminded of players that are not in the league anymore, but like Landry Fields. I see Landry Fields like in the Knicks starting lineup. It's like, oh yeah, I remember Landry Fields.
Those are two troubled franchises as you look at who they were playing. Last couple minutes here, one last benchmark for you guys. The man how time flies things from this game that stood out to you. And the one, well, there's two, I think, that stand out to me. Just the willingness to take 20-foot jump shots.
Yes.
Both teams, especially the Wolves.
I mean, that still kind of exists here.
For the Wolves, yeah, it does. It's true. But, like, just guys just pulling up. Sebastian Telfair just pulling up from 20 feet. That's not a play that should be run.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that stood out, I couldn't figure out watching the first 5 minutes of the game, why does this – this isn't that long ago. This looks so different. And it wasn't the pace as much. I mean, the pace was different. It was the fact that nobody was wearing the Under Armour leggings.
I thought about that, too.
Like, they all just had shorts and legs.
Yeah.
I think, and now everyone wears Under Armour leggings.
I think Corey Brewer might have had leggings on, but he was the only one.
Love had one sleeve on one of his knees.
It looks like he just had an old man high sock on. Yeah. That's what it looked like. Yeah. It didn't look like he had a sleeve. It looked like he had the old man high sock, which really fit him at the time.
No doubt. Absolutely. No, that's it. Those are good points. I was just trying to think about that, too. And I guess, like, I kind of go back to how Love has sort of changed, not only from, you know, his physical appearance, but also sort of this transformation in his personality. I still remember talking to him after the game, and you know, he was this young, excitable guy. And he, one of the quotes that was in my story that I wrote was, he said, you know, I look at it, and he's like, I kind of impressed myself. And he's like, and it wasn't like being like a, you know, ego filled guy. He was like speaking. He's like, I'm just trying to be honest here. Like I look at that and I don't believe it. And so there was this sort of bright eyed, youthful excitement and optimism about him then that has changed. I still really like him as a person. He's done a lot of great things for mental health awareness in the league and things, but he has so much changed and morphed into a kind of serious-minded, sometimes sullen, but just, you know, not as open and gregarious. It's just it's amazing to see how much a person can change in 8 years. I mean, it's just a big transformation.
Yeah. And I think the sports world and just social media, it feels like it's hard to you don't see many athletes who are on, you know, on a pedestal and who are being judged and critiqued at that level. You don't see them make it to their mid-30s bright-eyed still, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's always
it wears
sort
you
of
down.
A,
yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. Kevin Durant,
yep.
Even LeBron to some extent, right?
Sure. There's a cynicism or, you know, all that just comes with the reality of it. And, I mean, that's the world, especially now with all of the attention that comes on there. I think we were still at 2010, still sort of kind of coming into this era of social media and of just non-stop coverage and attention and all of that stuff. And yeah, it can wear on you for sure. Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
It's not a Wolves final thought, but it was really cool to see what Raymond Felton looked like 50 pounds ago for the Knicks, because he's put at least that much weight on since 2010.
Yes, he's just out there.
The
YMCA
opposite of Kevin Love. Yeah,
exactly.
I just look at the box score. And for both teams, when you, in terms of like how time has sort of flown by in the last 8 years with the Knicks, and we kind of alluded to it earlier with the Knicks only playing eight guys, they had three guys that played more than 40 minutes in this game. And none of the three were Amari Stoudemire.
Mm-hmm.
It was Wilson Chandler, Danilo Gallinari, and Raymond Felton. They
That's why
it
was so skinny.
Exactly.
And then the Wolves, Beasley and Love, both played 40 minutes in the game too. And that just you just don't in today's NBA, you know, unless Tom Thibodeau was coaching the team,
you don't
see teams playing guys out there, you know, for 40 plus minutes a night anymore, unless it's an overtime game or unless they're shorthanded and it's absolutely necessary for a guy to play. And also the other thing was 3-point shooting. Now for the Wolves, it was kind of a normal total that we've seen just in recent years. They were 8-for-20 from three, but the Knicks were 11-for-29. Imagine like a Mike D'Antoni team only shooting 29 threes in a game now.
Well, I still remember.
It's unfathomable now.
D'Antoni will still tell these stories when he's asked about it at Houston, about all these threes that they shoot. He's like, man, when we were in Phoenix, we shot 26 threes in a game. They looked at me like I was crazy. Like people said, what are you doing shooting all those threes? And now they're shooting 50 in a game. Yeah. Like
the Warriors get the credit for taking that style of basketball and bringing it to a championship level. But Mike D'Antoni is really the first one to go all out with that style.
No doubt.
And I hope he gets paid off at some point.
In Phoenix, they just couldn't figure out how to play defense. Yep. That was their problem because they were offensively what the Warriors were able to turn into before they got Kevin Durant. But the Warriors also played really good defense, mm-hmm. and that's why they won titles, and that's why the Suns didn't.
Draymond Green.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the Kevin Love 30-and-30 game, and just a couple of cheap plugs here. You can find all of John Krasinski's Timberwolves coverage at theathletic.com. Can people just go to theathletic.com/wolves or Timberwolves?
/Timberwolves, or you can just go to theathletic.com/MN for Minnesota, and that'll get you all of Wolves, Wild, Twins, all that stuff.
Awesome. So. And then if you guys want more of Manny Hill and Danny Cunningham, we have all of our Timberwolves-centric shows and basketball-centric shows. Just Score North Wolves anywhere you find your podcasts. That includes Raised by Wolves, Myron on Hoops, and more going forward. And I'm Phil Mackey from the Mackey and Judd with Rami show and other assorted things on Score North. If you enjoy these episodes of Minnesota Sports Rewind, you can help us spread the word by giving us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to the podcast, whether it's Apple or Spotify, and giving us a positive review. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.